You're listening to the Tupton Children Podcast.
Let's start with our motivation. So usually every day, all day, our attention is focused on ourselves and what's happening in our world. And this is regarded as the most important thing that is occurring in all of existence today. And yet, when we step back a moment, we see that what's happening to us is actually just one tiny thing, and that there's countless other living beings, all each one of them having their own experience. Each one of them struggling for happiness, struggling not to have even the tiniest suffering or inconvenience. So let's enlarge our perspective and recall that what's happening to us really isn't the most important thing in the universe. And since there's more of others than ourselves, that if we group everybody else together, their happiness becomes more important than our own individual happiness. And so in that way, we generate a mind that really cherishes others and is not so wrapped up and obsessed with ourselves, not so ego-sensitive. And so with that mind that cherishes others in that way, then we can look expansively for how to benefit them in the most effective way. And that turns out to be to attain the state of a Buddha ourselves, where we're free of all hindrances and have all good qualities. So let's generate the motivation to attain Buddhahood. For that reason, and really see that working for the benefit of all beings is really the only logical and natural thing to do. Isn't it more natural and logical to work for the benefit of all beings rather than just to benefit one being who happens just coincidentally to be me? If it were anybody else but me, would we say it makes more sense to benefit one person than to benefit countless beings? No, we wouldn't say that. But because that one person happens to be me, then the whole dynamic changes. Yeah. Now, does that make sense? For the whole dynamic to change just because that person happens to be me? We think, yes, because I'm the most important one. Definitely I'm the most important. So how are you going to prove that? What is your logical reasoning that is going to prove why you are the most important one?
How about because my pain doesn't hurt you?
Well, that's okay. Your pain doesn't hurt me. Why does that make me not the most important one? Yeah. I mean, the only reason we can give to back up our assertion that we're the most important one is because I'm me. There's no other reason. I mean, what other reason can you give why you're the most more important than anybody else?
I feel my pain more than I feel your pain.
Yeah, so what? So does everybody else. So why does that make you more important than anybody else if everybody else feels their own pain more than they feel other people's pain? That's the kind of reason we give to ourselves. Oh yeah, my pain hurts me, their pain doesn't, therefore I'm more important. But that reason makes sense to us. But does it make sense to the other person? If I say to you, yeah, I'm the more important because my pain hurts me and it doesn't hurt you, what are you going to say? Do you agree that makes me more important than everybody else? No, because you're going to say it's the same thing with me. So I'm the most important one.
That's why we have so many wars.
What?
That's why we have so many wars.
Exactly. This is why we have so many wars. Because we all think we're the most important ones. Yeah? And, you know, there's no good argument to prove that.
I want to argue with I'm the most important one to me because I'm the only one that's that important to me. But the truth is, it's not. I want everybody to know that I'm that is important. So I can't even make my own argument work.
So you can't say, you're saying, I say, well, I'm the most important because I think I'm the most important. But actually, you want everybody else to think you're the most important, too. So that argument doesn't really work for you. Yeah. We can't come up with any single good argument, you know? And this is really rather shocking to realize, especially when you're in the middle of an argument with somebody and we're defending our position and we're going to get our way and nobody else is going to tell me what to do. And nobody else is going to force me to do something. And I'm right. You know, when we're right in the middle of that emotion, in the middle of an argument, yeah, can we really prove to ourselves what's feeding that that self-centeredness? No, we can't prove it at all. And if we give these logical reasons to ourselves at that time, because our mind is so out of touch with reality, we just reject the logical reasons. We reject all reason. Yeah? And just come back to, I'm the most important because I'm me. And that is irrefutable. Well, it's irrefutable to us, but it's quite refutable to everybody else. So it's good to contemplate that, you know, and really use that to lower our sense of self-importance and lower this, you know, obsessive drive to always get our way and always feel comfortable and, you know, always be the best, and always be recognized, and on and on and on. Okay, so with that kind of motivation, maybe we can, you know, kind of generate some bodhicitta and start caring about others, and then start looking into the nature of this I, the nature of this person or self or I that we think is so important, because it feels so terribly solid, doesn't it? It's so real. Okay. So last week, in the question, somebody asked me, how do you meditate on emptiness? So I thought I would just mention some of those verses that we covered already that have to do with that. And then we're on verse 80 right now, and this verse and the future verses also go into this topic. Okay, so in verse 32, I think in the explanation of verse 32 I went through, the four-point analysis. So it's good to refer back to that. Then in verses 69 and 70, we refuted the inherent existence of that which has parts. In other words, that anything that has parts, you know, doesn't have its own essential identity. You know, solid, concrete self-identity. And then in verse 71, we had the refutation, checking whether, you know, if something is inherently existent, it would have to be either an inherently existent one thing or inherently existent many things. And so in verse 71, we examined that. And now in verse 80, which we just started last week, but we'll go into this week, we're examining again the selflessness of phenomena and persons by seeing that they are not inherently one or inherently separate from the part, their parts, and or their basis of designation. Okay, so let's go back here to verse 80. Okay, Nagarjuna says, the person is not earth, not water, not fire, not wind, not space, not consciousness, not all of them together. What person is there other than these? Okay, so this is how we are going to be examining to try and find the person. I'll just briefly go through it now and then cover some other material and come back to it, okay? But when we sit here, yeah, when you're sitting here, do you feel like you're right here where your body is? Yeah? Okay. And so what is right here? I mean, what's your body made out of? In the old version, I mean, they would say there's the earth element. In other words, something that's hard. There's the water element, something that is cohesive. The fire element, some warmth. The wind element is motion, and the space element, you know, and that the body is composed of those elements. And then together with the body, what makes a living being is there's consciousness. So it's not just the five physical elements, it's also the consciousness. And when we sit here in this room and say, I'm sitting here, don't we feel like, okay, there are those six things, and I'm right here with them. Yeah? Okay. So this is getting us to investigate. Okay. We feel like we're right here with those six constituents. Yeah. But if we were inherently existent, if we existed independent of all other phenomena, then we should be able to find what the I or the person is as either inherently one with those different parts or inherently separate from those different parts. Yeah. So, yeah, if we start asking, am I the earth element, the water element, the fire element, you know, am I any of those things individually? We can't say that we are. But we really think, not so much that we're one of those individually, but that we're the sum total of them. We're the whole collection. So if our feeling is, okay, I'm right here, and so are those six constituents. Then if you start going, like, just imagine you could take the earth element and toss it out and say, okay, I'm not earth. Toss that away. Yeah. And I'm not water. Toss that away. I'm not fire. Toss the fire element away. I'm not motion, you know, wind. Throw that element away. I'm not space. Throw that element away. I'm not consciousness. Throw that element away. Then, what's left? Where are you? There's nothing there. Okay. It gives you kind of a funny feeling, because before we started doing this, there was definitely a feeling of a person, a findable person, being there. Okay. But we're not any of those things, and we're not the collection of them either, so we can't really point to anything. Okay, so that's just the preview. So, this particular verse has quite a bit of meaning, and it's probably this verse that has the longest commentary to it. Okay? And so the key point of this verse is that the person and the aggregates or any other, you know, phenomena don't have even the slightest existence from their own side, even the slightest inherent existence. Yeah. And so they not only don't have even the slightest inherent existence, but, or and, they are merely posited through the force of nominal convention. They're merely posited through conception. Okay. So in other words, phenomena don't exist inherently, but they do exist conventionally. Okay, so not inherently existent is the meaning of there is not the slightest existence from their own side. And conventionally existent, which they are, is the meaning of posited merely through the force of nominal convention. Okay, so now, there's a quotation from another one of Nagarjuna's works called The 60 Stanzas of Reasoning. So there's this is all taken from Gelsabje's commentary. He quotes this other verse. So here Nagarjuna says, since the Buddhas have stated that the world is conditioned by ignorance, why isn't it reasonable to assert that this world is a result of conceptualization? Okay, since the Buddhas have stated that the world is conditioned by ignorance, why isn't it reasonable to assert that this world is the result of conceptualization? This kind of makes it sound like conceptualization is the problem. Here, conceptualization means conceptualization of inherent existence. Okay? Just regular conceptualization, you know, I walk the dog. There's nothing wrong with that. And there's nothing wrong with labeling things. This is a thermos, this is a recorder, this is a mouse, you know? Nothing wrong with labeling things. But the problem is when we forget that we labeled and gave those names to those things, and we start thinking that the object labeled, the labeled object, yeah, the designated object, is that basis of designation. Okay? So when we forget that, oh, I just called this a thermos, and we start seeing this is a thermos. Okay? That's where the grasping at true existence comes in. Okay? This is a thermos. It has the nature of thermosness inside of it. That's where we run into trouble. Okay? And then especially when we label it my thermos, it has the nature of my inside of it. Then we really have a lot of interest in it. Okay. So the world is conditioned by ignorance in that our environment and all the living beings in it arise due to self-grasping ignorance, okay, which is the chief affliction, which is the root of samsara. And so the Buddha explained that from that self-grasping ignorance arises all the afflictions, and then due to the afflictions, we create the karma to be reborn in cyclic existence and to take these five polluted aggregates. Yeah, the aggregates are called polluted because they're taken under the influence of ignorance. And these five aggregates, you know, are not something that's really fantastic to be glued to. If we don't think about it, we think our five aggregates are wonderful. I'm so glad I have a body. This body can bring me so much pleasure. I'm a real person with a body because then people can see my face and know who I am. I have an identity, you know. So we get quite attached. So, you know, these aggregates are polluted, but we get quite attached to them and think, oh, they're the source of my identity, and I want to have an identity because then I exist. Yeah. Okay, so that creates a whole lot of problems because these aggregates, when we look at them, they're really nothing spectacular. Take our body, for example. Yeah. Is our body spectacular? Yeah. Just mentally open it up. Liver, spleen, blood, guts, lymph, intestines, lungs, esophagus, tongue, brains, tissue. Is that such a wonderful thing that you want to be attached to, glued to, forever and ever and ever? Think about it. Yes, it's totally unreliable because it gets sick like this, it dies like this, and it's getting old automatically. And you can't stop it from getting old. Okay? So this is our situation in samsara, the root cause being ignorance. But the world does not exist in the way it appears to ignorance. Nor does it exist in the way that ignorance apprehends it. Okay? So when we realize that the conceived object of the self-grasping ignorance does not exist the way the self-grasping ignorance apprehends it, then we realize that the person, the aggregates, or whatever object we're analyzing does not exist inherently. So it appears inherently existent, but it doesn't exist that way. Okay. However, the mere person and the mere aggregates or mere phenomena that are the focal objects of the self-grasping ignorance and the focal objects of reliable cognizers, these things exist conventionally by mere name, by mere designation or conceptualization. Okay. So the inherently existent things that are the focal, that are the conceived object or apprehended object of the self-grasping, those inherently existent things do not exist at all. But the focal object of the self-grasping, just the basic object that the self-grasping is focused on, and the basic object that reliable cognizers are focused on, that is a conventionally existent thing that exists by mere designation. Okay, you with me? It's weird. Yeah, because, you know, we have a hard time differentiating the inherently existent one and the one that exists by mere conceptualization. Okay, so to actually have a full understanding, a full realization of emptiness, we, after realizing emptiness, we must realize the nominal existence of those things that are empty. So, you know, we don't realize the non-existence of the empty things. We realize their nominal existence, their conventional existence. But we realize the non-existence of inherently existent things. Okay? So, refuting the false mode of existence, inherent existence of the object, does not negate the general conventional existence of the object. And in fact, when we refute an inherently existent thing, we are implicitly implying, we are implicitly positing a conventional object as existing by mere name and convention due to the force of conceptualization. So when we're refuting an inherently existent object, we're implicitly positing an existent object that exists by mere conceptualization. Because if we weren't implicitly positing the existence of a nominal object, then when we realized emptiness, we would fall to nihilism and think that nothing whatsoever existed. We would just negate inherent existence and say nothing exists, which is incorrect. Okay? So, you know, this is the essential meaning of all the Majjhimaka texts. Yeah, so they all, these texts may explain all sorts of other topics, but the basic thing they come back to is the compatibility of emptiness of inherent existence and dependent arising, that all persons and phenomena lack existence from their own side, but exist dependently. And what does dependent existence mean? Dependent, well, for things, it means dependent on causes and conditions. And for all phenomena, it means dependent on parts, mutually dependent, and especially dependent on conceptualization. Yeah, the mind conceiving and giving a name to it. Okay, so in general, understanding that phenomena exist as mere designations does not arise automatically from understanding emptiness. It only comes after you've contemplated many reasons that lead to an inferential understanding of emptiness. Okay, because actually realizing that things exist as mere designations is more difficult than realizing that they're empty of inherent existence. So first, you may realize things are dependent in, for example, on causes and conditions or on parts. Then you realize their emptiness. When you come out of that, that's when you gain a reliable cognizer that they're dependent on name and conceptualization. However, okay, how quickly you gain that reliable cognizer when you come out of your meditation on emptiness depends on how much you thought about things existing by mere conceptualization before you went into that meditative equipoise on emptiness. So that's why now, yeah, we keep talking and hearing about things existing, you know, by the force of conceptualization. Because by hearing about that now, even though we can't realize it now, because we haven't realized emptiness, by hearing about it now, then after we have a realization of emptiness, especially a direct realization of emptiness. When we come out of that, it will be much easier to see that things exist by mere designation, that things exist as like illusions. Okay, so it's like planting the seed of that understanding in us now, and it will ripen later. Okay, so the ease with which we're able to recognize or realize that things, exist dependent on conceptualization, depends on our familiarity with that, just that idea, and how much we've thought about it before we realize emptiness. Okay? So, this is a subtle point. And let alone the Vipassikas, Satantrikas, and Chittamajans not understanding it, even the Svatantrika Madhyamikas don't understand it. Yeah? So, of course, we're not going to get it right away if these great sages have a difficult time understanding it. We won't get it right away. But just hearing about this, thinking about it, puzzling about it, will give us some familiarity. Yeah? Okay. So they always start with some very ridiculously easy example. Yeah, but the reason they start with something ridiculously easy is so that we can understand it. Okay, so they usually start with the example of the president. Yeah. So Obama is president simply because he's designated president. Yeah. In other words, if the people did not give him the label president, did not give him the designation president, yeah, then he could not do the job of a president. Yeah. So he exists as the president simply, on the basis of the country having an election, won the vote of the Electoral College. Then that means that you get he gets the designation of president, and then he can function as the president. Okay? But when you look at it that way, you just see that being president is simply a designation, isn't it? There's nothing solid about it. You couldn't look inside of his body and find the president there. Yeah. So in one way, it's very easy, isn't it? Because he got the name. If you have a job, you're the manager or you're the co-worker, whatever job title you have, don't you do that role because you have that name? Yeah, you do that function simply, and the company permits you to do that function simply because you have that name and they conceive of you like that. If they didn't give you that name, if people conceived of you as something else, you may be very qualified for the job, but you can't do it. Okay? Yeah. So it's interesting, even with, I love coming back to this thing of my. Yeah. Do you remember when you went away to summer camp, how you always had to stitch in these little labels with your name on them? On your clothes and everything like that. Or when you went to school, you always had to put your name in your books. Or when you had gym clothes. Oh, remember those awful white gym clothes? Ours were white and they constantly got dirty. But, you had to write in a marking pen your name on, at least we had to, on one of the cuffs, and that made it mine, So that ink put in a certain shape that we decided, pronounced like my name, made those gym clothes mine. You know? And that's all. There's nothing in those gym clothes. Or that sleeping bag, or that textbook that we carried around, that is mine. Except that there's our name in it. There's nothing else about the object that's mine. And it could have just as soon been somebody else's name put in that book. If I had, when they were passing out books, if I took a different one instead of that one, I would have put my name in a different one, and that one would have been mine. And my book would have belonged to somebody else. So there's nothing in the book that makes it mine, except the name. And the fact that as a society, we conceptualize, oh, your name's on it, that means it's yours. And then when we say, that society say it's yours, then that means you can do all sorts of things with it. Whereas when society says it's not yours, then you can't do those things with it. And if you do, you get arrested for stealing. Okay? But, you know, ownership is simply a matter of labels. Yeah? And, you know, here we are. We're going through this whole process of escrow to get this piece of property down the lane. And all we're trying to do is change the designation from Green's property to Srivasti Abbey's property. That's all we're trying to do, is just change a label. And look what we've been going through. Look at everything you have to go through. And the title report is, you know, the description, the label, the property number. You know, some of these things weren't correct. You know, how can it be ours if it's not the right number? Because, you know. Okay. So everything is just, all we're trying to do is change the designation. And by changing the designation, then we get to use that in a way that we didn't get to use it before. And there's nothing physically that we give the Greens in exchange for it. We have just as much stuff as we had before. Plus, we get 60 acres of property. And we didn't even give them any material objects. That's kind of a rip-off, isn't it? You know? All they get is just certain numbers written in a bank account. That's all. They don't get anything except, you know, certain squiggles. You know, because that's all your bank account is squiggles, isn't it? It's just squiggles. So the squiggle in our bank account changes, the squiggle in their bank account changes, but we get 60 acres out of it. You know?
Well, they get some chocolates.
Huh? They get some chocolate, yes. We get the napkin. That's true. Okay.
I'm not sure that's a good deal.
But if you're a goat, the knapweed is heaven.
You should get goats then.
So a goat would say, you're getting 60 acres of knapweed? That's fantastic. Yeah, that's like chocolate to me. Yum, 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 yum. Okay. And then when they find out that 28 acres are not knapweed, it's in forest exemption, then the poor goats are disappointed. We only have 29 acres of knapweed. Okay? So now, then there's a... yeah, I mean, when you think about this, it's completely ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah? And some people, their whole job, like at this, the title company, is just to look at names and numbers and, you know, change names and numbers. That's all. And then they get paid by You know, what do they get in exchange? They get different squiggles on their bank account. But where is your bank account?
In the cloud.
Yeah. Where is your bank account? Is your bank account that little, you know, your little book? Yeah, you know, that you write checks in and you keep the balance. Is that your bank account? Yeah? If you walked into the bank where your bank account is located and said, I want to see my bank account, what can they show you? Can they show you your bank account? Yeah, they show you a computer screen that has some dots on it. Yeah?
Pixels.
Yeah, a bunch of pixels, whatever it is. Yeah? I mean, that's all your bank account is. You can't even see it. You can't even hold it in your hands. But we get so elated or so depressed based on the arrangement of the pixels, or the arrangements of the squiggles in, you know, our book.
And it determines on who eats and who doesn't eat in this world.
Yeah, exactly. It determines who eats and who doesn't eat, and who has a roof over their head and who doesn't. It's really ridiculous, isn't it, when you think about it? And the whole thing is conceptually created by human beings. Yeah? Without us human beings, there wouldn't be any banks, there wouldn't be all those squiggles, there wouldn't be pixels.
Just napweed.
Yeah. Just napweed, yeah. The world, imagine. This is our new concentration, not the world covered by bones, but the world covered by napweed. The people who just arrived don't know what we're talking about. You'll learn. We'll introduce you to the napweed.
But would it make any difference if you have to cut gold bars out to get a piece of land? Cart gold bars down.
Oh, yeah.
Would it make any difference?
No. I mean, carting gold bars somewhere. What do gold bars do? They're heavy. And you have to schlep them. And it's only because human beings gave gold with our mind. We gave them value, that they have value. Otherwise, I mean, if you're starving, you could have a pile of gold bars and it doesn't solve your hunger. Unless the people around you attribute values to those gold bars, then you can exchange them for some food. Yeah? But otherwise, really, you know, gold, so what? You know, again, why don't we just exchange napweed? Why don't we use napweed for money? We would be millionaires!
We are goats.
Okay, so now there's another, Gelsamje quotes another verse. This one's by Aryadeva from the 400 stanzas. Okay, so he says, it's verse 178, apart from conceptuality, desire and so forth have no existence. Who with intelligence would hold there are real things imputed by conceptuality? Just the whole thing, just the phrase, real things imputed by conceptuality. That's an oxymoron, isn't it? You know, if something's imputed, it's just created by conceptuality, it can't be real. And yet, we give these things a lot of value, don't we? Yeah? just thinking, you know, when you're going to purchase that, we get this whole, all these sheets of paper, you know, where they had to talk about the state of the property and check different boxes, you know. All it is paper and ink. And yet, we use it and, you know, evaluate the property by that. Then we have to go out and have an inspection exam to see if what they said is true, if things still work like that. Yeah. And so the inspector gives us more pieces of paper. And then we point at our pieces of paper, and then we point at their pieces of paper, and we say they don't match. And so you have to change your squiggles because our piece of paper has these squiggles on it that have this meaning. Yeah? Whole thing is made up, isn't it? Yeah? And then we get so attached to it, we get so angry at it, you know? They want to change the squiggles on the piece of paper after we agreed what the squiggles look like. They want to change the shape of the ink. How dare they? Yeah? It's amazing, isn't it? Okay. So Aryadeva says, apart from conceptuality, desire, attachment, anger, all these things have no existence apart from the conceptuality that's conceiving true existence. Okay, so who with intelligence would hold there are real things imputed by conceptuality? So Geshe-la says, actually this verse and the preceding verse, the preceding quotation, are very difficult to understand, and very learned scholars have to debate and discuss these verses a lot to understand them. Okay, but the essential point turns out to be the same thing we were talking about before, that because everything is merely designated by conception, it's not appropriate for the intelligent to apprehend things as existing from their own side. Yeah, we should know that they're only merely designated by convention, by conception on the conventional level. Okay? So Chandrakirti wrote a commentary to Aryadeva's text, and he explained this verse, and he said that it means if it does not exist, if something does not exist by mere conceptual designation, it does not exist. Okay? Or put it this way, if something exists, let me rephrase this, if something exists by mere conceptual designation, it exists. And if it does not exist by mere conceptual designation, it does not exist. Whoa!
Can you repeat that?
That's from Chandrakirti's commentary on Aryadeva's 500. Okay. But having said that, if something exists by mere conceptualization, it exists. Yeah? It doesn't say if something is merely conceptually designated, it exists. Because not everything that is conceptually designated exists. Okay? So it says if it exists by mere conceptualization, it exists. It doesn't say if it is merely conceptualized, it exists. Because there's a lot of things that we conceptualize that don't exist. Aside from a rabbit's horn, a turtle's mustache, and weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Yeah? We fought a war over a conceptualization that had no basis for that designation. Isn't that amazing? I mean, it was weapons of mass destruction, you know, a conceptualized item. And there was no basis of designation for that. And yet how many people lost their lives because of it? Because we couldn't tell. We couldn't tell what was an accurate designation and what was an inaccurate designation. Yeah. So it's like, you know, all these people believe that that turtles had mustaches, and they fought a war over turtles' mustaches. Yeah, it's ridiculous, isn't it?
It's generally what we fight.
What?
It's generally what we fight.
Yeah, but there's no such thing as a turtle's mustache. Why are we fighting over things that don't exist? Okay? So now this gets really interesting. So the way in which things are merely designated by conception is similar to a snake being merely designated by conception on a rope. Okay? So take this situation. That you're in a dim room, so there's not so much light, you can't see things clearly. Yeah? So you're like in the basement or something, or maybe in the garage. Yeah? You look over to the corner, and there's this striped, coiled thing in the corner. And you see this striped, coiled thing in the corner, and you go, "That's a snake." Yeah? And especially if you live in California and it's like, "It's a rattler. This is dangerous." Yeah? So we totally freak out. Yeah? So, but when we, okay. So based on the striped coiled object, we imagined a snake. We designated snake. We got emotional because we thought there was a snake. There's no snake there. And that snake was completely fabricated by the mind. Isn't it? The snake on that rope, completely made up by the mind. There's no snake on that rope. Absolutely. I mean, can you get that feeling when you think of it? There is absolutely no snake there. Absolutely. You could look at the rope any way you want to. There is no snake there. Okay. But in the same way that that snake is merely conceptualized and imputed independence on the rope, all phenomena exist by being fabricated by thought, conceptualized and imputed by thought. Okay? So when the physical, when our body and mind appear, the physical and mental aggregates appear, we conceive of a person and designate I, or you, or he, or she, or Harry, or Joan, or whoever it is. Okay? But there's no person there on the mental and physical aggregates, okay? Because you could look as much as you want through that collection of aggregates. You cannot find the person in the body. You cannot find it in the feelings, in the discriminations, in the compositional factors, in the primary consciousnesses. Anywhere you look, in those five parts that make up that collection, you cannot find a person. And yet, we say there's a person there, and we believe there's a person there. But actually, the person is fabricated by conception, independence on the aggregates, in the same way that the snake is fabricated by conception on the coiled striped rope. There's no difference in terms of their being merely imputed by term and concept. There's no difference in terms of their being merely fabricated. Now, when you look at our little kitty, Mudita, there. Mudita, show your face. When you look at Mudita, or Maitri, is more visible. You look at Maitri. Does Maitri look like she's merely fabricated?
No.
No. That does not look like a mere fabrication. Yeah. And we look at that, we say, no, she's not. The snake and the rope, that's a fabrication. But that cat sitting there is not a fabrication. That cat is real. That is a real cat. Don't we all agree? It's a real cat. Yeah. And we would bet our life on that being a real cat. But if it's a real cat, what about it is the real cat? What are you going to point to that is the cat? The ears, the fur, the intestines, the teeth,
the tail,
her belly.
What belly? No money, no food.
Somebody says, what is a cat there? What are you going to point to that is the cat? Is her mind a cat? What are you going to point to? I mean, look, just look at that. And you know, go from, that's a cat, I'm sure that's a cat. And everybody agrees with me, that's a cat. And then look, and it's like, what is a cat about that? What am I going to point to that is the cat? Does it look different to you when you go between those two ways of looking at it? Yeah? Or look at Venerable Sultra. And you say, there's a person. Okay? There's a person. Yeah? I mean, we all agree there's a person, a real person there. But what are you going to point to that is the person? Who exactly is Venerable Sultra? What are you going to point to?
Good question.
Yeah. What are you going to point to that is her?
The tattoo?
The shades.
Is the shape? If you say the shape is her, then you could draw that same shape on cardboard and that would be her.
The collection of all of it.
So a collection of different things that are not Venerable Sultram. You put a bunch of non-Sultrams together and you get a Sultram. You take a bunch of non-apples, put them in a pile, and you get an apple. That's not going to work.
Well, she wasn't there, really, and we made a Sultram out of her.
Yeah. She was a Terry, and we made her into Sultram. Exactly. Yeah. But in some situations, she's still Terry.
Yep.
Yeah. When you go to the doctors, you're Terry, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah. When you're here, you're Sultram.
She was backing up our habits.
Okay. But, you know, when you think about it, her existing as Sultram, that existing as a cat, You know, it's the same dynamic as imputing snake on a rope. Our mind takes a basis and puts a name on it. And then we see it that way. There was a striped coiled thing, we put the name rope, snake on it. There's a body and mind, we put the name Sultram on it. Yeah, same mechanism. But then we go, wait a minute, there's some difference. What's the difference? Okay, that thing curled in the corner doesn't function like a snake. But that thing curled in the corner functions as Venerable Sultram.
Dimly lit room. It's you first.
Yeah. Okay. So there's some difference. Yeah. But in the way that it's imputed and fabricated by mind, the two things are the same. Okay. But in another way, the snake on the rope doesn't exist at all. Yeah. Venerable Sultram on that collection of parts exists. You know, or independence on that collection of parts exists. Okay, there's a person there. Yeah, she walks and scowls and everything else.
That's not what that says. But I appreciate it.
Okay, so both the snake and Venerable Sultram are the same in terms of being merely designated by conception and not being findable within their basis of designation, the rope and the aggregates respectively. There is a difference because the rope doesn't exist at all and Venerable Sultram, the snake doesn't exist at all and Venerable Sultram does. Okay, so how do we know that the I, that Venerable Sultram exists, even though she can't be found in the aggregates or separate from the aggregates? Yeah, when we look at that pile of aggregates over there, can you point to something that's Venerable Sultram about them? Nothing. There's absolutely nothing there. Yeah, that you could say is Venerable Sultram. Yeah. And especially if you came into the room and you didn't know who she was, you wouldn't say Venerable Sultram. Yeah. You might say person. But even if we say person, what about those things sitting there is a person? Yeah, we can't find it, okay? But the person exists even though it can't be found in the aggregates. Yeah, and it can't be found separate from the aggregates. So it exists even though it can't be found. Okay? Well, we have to understand here, it can't be found by ultimate analysis. It can be found by a conventional reliable cognizer, because if somebody walks in the room and says, where is Venerable Sultram? We say she's sitting over there and we all understand. So she can be found in the room, but she can't be found in the aggregates or separate from the aggregates. Okay, because we're looking with two different types of mind. The conventional mind, where's Venerable Sultram? Right there. Where's the person? There. Okay? But the mind of ultimate analysis, what really is the person? You can't find anything. It totally evaporates. You have nothing there. Okay? But on the conventional level, the person exists, but the snake doesn't. Okay? Because the person fulfills three criteria for conventional existence. Okay, so first, the person is commonly known in the world. So we all know that a person exists. You know, it walks and talks and eats and talks, you know, debates, squiggles. Okay? So we all know that a person exists and it does actions and experiences three selves. So there's conventional, it's known conventionally, you know, just in the world. Yeah. Second thing is that the existence of that person isn't contradicted by a conventional reliable cognizer. In other words, everybody else, you know, looks at that and says, oh yeah, that's a person. And it functions like a person. Okay? And third criteria is the existence of the person isn't contradicted by a probing awareness analyzing the ultimate nature. Okay, so that probing awareness that's trying, you know, that's the ultimate analysis, it doesn't contradict the existence of the person because that ultimate analysis cannot see conventionally existent things. Okay? Because conventionally existent things are out of the purview of a mind of ultimate analysis.
I get that, but I don't get, what conventional? All three have to be at
all point. Three have to be there.
But
yeah.
It's kind of like the third one is a little hard.
Well, what the third one does is it negates things being inherently existent. So we might say, oh yeah, the thermos is conventionally known in the world. The thermos is perceived by other, you know, reliable cognizers. But if we're thinking of the thermos as inherently existent, an inherently existent thermos does not exist, and it's the third criteria that shows that an inherently existent thermos does not conventionally exist. Okay? Okay. On the other hand, the existence of the snake can be disproved. Because a rope being a snake is not commonly accepted in the world. Okay. Second, people with unimpaired senses in a brightly lit room cannot establish a snake, you know, do not see a snake there. Okay, people, you know, with unimpaired senses in a brightly lit room don't see a snake, they see a rope. Okay. And then third, a probing awareness cannot establish a snake there. Any snake. Because a probing awareness that's analyzing the ultimate, conventionally existent things are not in its purview.
Yeah, but that's what makes it hard for the other example, is it only seeing emptiness.
So. Yeah.
Can't establish a rope is there.
Can't establish a rope is there.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's not contradicting anything. Okay. So in short, the stanza from the 60 stanzas explains that although phenomena are not truly existent, due to true grasping ignorance, afflictions arise, karma's created, and due to this, the environment and sentient beings come into existence. So that's the way of seeing things coming into existence. Yeah, based on the conceptualization of inherent existence. Yeah. And though they come into existence due to true grasping, they are not truly existent. They exist by mere designation. Okay. So the stanza from the 400 explains that true dukkha and true origins exist by being merely fabricated by thought. So we're going to say, what? The four truths for the Aryas are merely fabricated by thought? No, the Buddha spoke them. They're absolutely, positively true. They're not fabricated. Sorry, they are fabricated by thought. Because apart from being merely designated, we cannot find true you know, true dukkha or true origins of dukkha. Okay? So therefore, the wise don't grasp, you know, any of the four truths as inherently existent. Nor do they deny that they're merely conventionally designated. Okay, so all phenomena exist by being merely designated or fabricated by conception. And to illustrate this, they gave the example of a snake being imputed, you know, on a coiled rope. Now, for years, I've heard this example of the snake and the rope, and I always scratch my head, and it's like, what kind of example is that? What nonsense is that? You know, but when you really look at it, when you really think about that rope, and it's like, there is no snake there, totally. And then you think of the aggregates, and you say, there is no person there, absolutely no person. And then you look out at somebody you see, and you see a person. And then you go, whoa, my mind is way out of touch with reality. Because there's no person there that can be found independent of this conceptualization process. Okay? So I'm going over time, but I want to finish this section here. Okay? So Jay Rinpoche draws on these two stanzas to explain the object of negation, which, as we know, is the first step in realizing emptiness, if we use that one reasoning. Okay, anything more than what is merely designated by conception is the object of negation. Whoa! Anything more than what is merely designated by conception is the object of negation. Any more existence there in the object from its own side, independent of conceptualization. That kind of existence that we see all the time does not exist. That's the object of negation. Anything more than what is merely designated by conception is the object of negation. In other words, it doesn't exist. Yeah, anything more than what is merely designated by conception is inherent existence. Doesn't exist. Okay, so these two verses highlight two key points of the Kaprasangika view. One is the reasons why phenomena do not exist inherently and the faults of believing in them to exist that way. And two, the meaning of mere designation by conception and why phenomena do exist in that way. So both these verses are talking about emptiness and dependent arising. So now we're coming back to verse 80. So verse 80 explains that the basis of designation of the person is the six constituents, you know, earth, water, fire, air, space, wind, space, and consciousness. And although it's usually said that the five aggregates are the basis of designation, there's no contradiction in saying that these six constituents are the basis of designation, because it comes to the same point. The five, you know, earth, water, you know, these ones are the form aggregate, and consciousness applies to the other four aggregates, okay? So when meditating on emptiness, we don't look for an inherently existent person. Rather, we search to see if the person inherently exists. Okay. We don't look for an inherently existent person. An inherently existent person doesn't exist. Why are we looking for it? But we do check to see if a person exists inherently. We check to see how does the person exist. So if it existed inherently, it would have to be like this and like that. It would have to be one with its parts or separate from its parts. It would have to be, you know, independent of its basis of designation. It would have to be findable by ultimate analysis. Okay. And then we go and see if, you know, that's the way the person or anything else exists. Can we find it inside its basis of inside its parts, or can we find it separate from its parts? Okay? And then, although an inherently existent person is an object of meditation in the meditation on emptiness, okay, and is the first step, and the first step of meditating on emptiness is to identify the object of negation, we actually can't realize an inherently existent person with a reliable cognizer because it doesn't exist. So we're being asked to identify this first step of identifying the object of negation. It's a little bit of a double bind because you can't perceive it by a reliable cognizer because it doesn't exist. Okay? So rather, we say that if such a person existed, it would be like this and it would be like that. Okay, so we think of what an inherently existent person would be like if it existed. Okay, it would be totally independent of causes and conditions, of parts, of name and conceptuality, and so on. And then we investigate to see whether the person exists in any of those ways. Okay, is it one with its parts? Is it separate? Is it one with its basis of designations? Separate from it. Okay. So when we think about this verse, and then think about the two verses, other verses, one by Nagarjuna and one by Aryadeva explained in here, then we really see there's a whole lot of meaning going on in this verse. There's a whole lot of stuff to meditate on. Okay? So for the person who asked, how do we meditate on emptiness? Contemplate this explanation. Yeah. Try and find the snake in the rope. Try and find a truly existent person in the aggregate. Okay?
When you're doing that, what is the part of the mind that wants to just say, oh yeah, it's not there, and you don't really get a feeling for anything? What is that?
That's just the superficial mind that hasn't identified the object of negation. Yeah. It's the mind that just mix the conventionally existent thing and the object of negation together. So we don't get any feeling from it at all. But it's like, you know, you have to really look at how you see things. And like we were doing, you know, that is a cat. Definitely. You know, you call up that feeling, that is a cat. Or a feeling, I am me, I am sitting here, I am real. And you call up that feeling of how you feel of being a real thing. Yeah? Kind of like, well, that's got to exist. That's who I am, that's got to exist. If that doesn't exist, what doesn't exist? Then what does? I know I exist. But then you check.
Yeah. I believe so strongly in the fabrication that even in the face of evidence, you go, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like that belief supersedes everything.
Yeah. We are so entrenched in our wrong conception that it's like even though somebody says there is no snake there and shines a light on it and pokes it, and picks it up, we still say it's a snake.
That's ignorance.
That's ignorance, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. In the Zen monastery where I stayed for some time, we had an example, the abbot, he put a box in front of us and he said, I put a snake into it to see how our reaction is, and he gave us the option to leave the room now before he's leaving, releasing the snake. So not only, you know, the imagination there could be a snake in this box, he put snake on the box, just that. Some people left
too. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. With the statement that object of negation can't be perceived by a reliable cognizer, is
yeah.
that dismissing all conventional?
No. The object of negation is what does not exist. It's an inherently existent thing. Inherently existent things do not exist. They cannot be perceived by reliable cognizers. Conventionally existent things exist. They can be perceived by reliable cognizers.
So even if we perceive something to be inherently existent, that's not really perceiving it, that's just fabricating.
That's not really.
We look at things and see them as inherently existent.
Yeah.
When
things are just appearing to us, as inherently existent. That's a mistaken appearance. But lots of times we grasp things as inherently existent and we are thoroughly convinced that what we are perceiving is real. We never doubt it. And that is exactly what doesn't exist. So, you know, when somebody insults us and we feel, how dare you insult me? We are not perceiving reality at that moment, even though we sure feel like we do. We sure feel like there's a real me there that's getting insulted. That kind of me does not exist. A conventional person exists, but that truly existent one does not exist.
And you wouldn't call that a reliable cognizer?
No. If you were talking about the conventionally existent thing, the reliable cognizer, yes, could perceive it. But a reliable cannot recognizer. Does a reliable cognizer perceive the snake on the rope?
No.
Why not?
Because it's a rope, it's not a snake.
There's no snake there.
Right, yeah.
So how can a reliable cognizer see an inherently existent person? There's no inherently existent person there, so how can it see it? The reliable cognizer can see the snake. The reliable cognizer can see the nominally existent person. Those things exist. But you see, our problem is we can't differentiate the nominally existent one and the inherently existent one. So when the inherently existent one is refuted, we say you're refuting the existence of the person altogether. And this is exactly what the preceding verses, what Nagarjuna was warning us about. Yeah? We negate too much.
The reliable cognizer sees the rope.
Yeah.
But it's mistaken.
It's mistaken because the rope appears truly existent and it isn't.
That's what I'm getting at. That's not.
But appearance and apprehend are different. Something appearing truly existent is different than that mind assenting to that appearance and holding it as truly existent.
So the word perceive is being used as that, like apprehended.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Appears. Okay.
Okay.
But no wonder, because that's what we perceive.
Yeah, that's what we perceive. We think it's real. You know, you see the ghost sitting next to you when you come out of the haunted, what is it, the haunted
house?
Haunted house at Disneyland. There's, you see the ghost. There's an appearance of a ghost there. Yeah. Do you accept that appearance as true? If you're a little kid, maybe yes. That's not a valid cognizer. It's not a reliable cognizer because there's no ghost there. As an adult, you don't hold that ghost as being there, but you still, it still appears to you, even though you know it's false. Think about the reflection in the mirror. Okay? So we have to stop now, and you have to think. Yeah? I can't answer all of your questions. You have to think and investigate for yourself. Okay?
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase.
To this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Flurry.